politics around abortion are going to be very interesting this year. I will give you details. I want to start with some audio from a golfer. That and more on this week's Corey Truax Show. This one might be a little longer than usual. I have five or six things on the prep sheet I want to get to, so we will be efficient as we can be while also elaborating to the point where I hope illuminate some things in your own thinking, challenge some thinking, and give you some information you might not otherwise have. If you hear my voice as a little odd, that's not because of a setting on your AirPods or earbuds or your radio in your car. Pollen has just killed me. I used to brag. Middle school, high school, I'd brag to people even through my early adulthood. I don't have an allergy to pollen. And people around me would be suffering, and I would just have no problem with spring allergies. And they are killing me this year. But I'm just going to be brave and muscle through, because that's the totality of the hard part of my life, is I'm going to talk for 40 to 45 minutes while having a pollinated voice. Welcome to the Corey Truax Show, wherever you find podcasts. I am genuinely grateful that you listen. Thank you for giving me this time every single week. And a special thank you to our monthly supporters and, of course, our sponsor, who I'll get to a little bit later. Thanks to all of you that take part in the show every week. I do not take that for granted. I get to do a lot of things, but one of them is serving the awesome people of Beechwood Church. I get to serve lots of different times, I guess all the time. But a primary way, Sunday mornings at 10:30. We meet in Greenville. You can find us. Just Google Beechwood Church. You will find us there. And that's, yeah, oh yeah, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads. You can find me. Look for my weird name, Corey Truax. You can also email the show at CoreyTruaxShow@gmail.com, CoreyTruaxShow@gmail.com. I was going to start with the abortion politics of 2024 because they are shifting and interesting, especially when I find out this week my audience has some younger folks in it I didn't know about. Or I didn't recognize. I want to give you guys some context. I've been alive for almost 40 years now. I've got a good bit of an historian brain. And so around this topic, we really are entering a new era, and it's worth knowing our context and setting some things down as we go into a new era in this particular campaign season. I want to start here, though. I'm not a golf guy. I love, obviously, football. I will watch basketball when it gets to the playoffs. I will watch baseball probably when it gets to the playoffs, and even then, I mean, I can't watch 9 innings of a game typically. I don't know. They have a new pitch clock that makes it faster, so maybe I can muscle through and watch a baseball game. I don't watch golf at all. Find it boring. But there's a guy named Scottie Scheffler. Never heard of that guy until this week. And I've only heard of him because he won arguably the biggest golf tournament in the world, the Masters, and he started being all over my Facebook feed, Twitter feed, Instagram feed. I mean, he was everywhere. And I needed to find out why. And why so many Christians were sharing him. And I found one piece of audio that I thought was phenomenal when one reporter asked him, what's your identity? Or how do you identify yourself? Something like that. And he said, well, I'm not a golfer. He says, I identify with Christ. I'm first his. It's the kind of thing that we need said much more often in public settings. So what I want to play for you now is my favorite thing he said. This is one of the biggest platforms in the world, winning the Masters. Minutes later, an hour later, being on the pedestal in the press conference, this is what this young man, I believe he's in his late 20s, said I forgot the question, but incredible answer. I don't know why someone put dramatic music behind it, but it does make it a little better. Here you go.
I was a bit overwhelmed because I told him, I was like, I wish that I didn't want to win as badly as I did.
The context here is he's talking to his friends that morning, going into the final morning of the biggest golf tournament in the world, saying, I wish I didn't want it this badly. Hold on to that line. It's important. I wish I didn't want to win this badly.
Or as badly as I do. I think it would make the mornings easier. But I love winning. I hate losing. I really do. And when you're here in the biggest moments, when I'm sitting there with the lead on Sunday, I really, really want to win badly. And my buddies told me this morning, you know, my victory was secure on the cross. And that's a pretty special feeling, to know that I'm secure for forever. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether or not I win this tournament or if I lose this tournament. You know, my identity is secure for forever.
It doesn't get much better than that. Now, that's a little Christianese. It requires some explanation. I think he's given us as Christians an opportunity in conversation with people to explain what that means. He was talking about a golf tournament, wanting to win it, but then his friends remind him, your victory was secured on the cross. Let me just comment on this really quickly. Two comments, one on the substance and then one on the broader meaning. I would challenge all of us to find the thing in our hearts, or maybe it's been something in the past, that we would put in place of that first sentence where I wanted to win so badly. That was his thing. Win the Masters. And my identity, whether I rise and fall, might be on that, whether or not I win the Masters, being able to then replace it with, well, my victories was won on the cross. I'm in Christ. I got all I need, no matter what happens with this first thing. So for some, it is getting into this med school, grad school, law school. I want it so badly. And do you want it so badly that your identity in Christ is wrecked or not worth enough to you because you don't have this other thing? I wanted to be married so badly. Here's one that hurts a bunch of people. I wanted to have kids so badly. I wanted that promotion, that job. I wanted that particular person to love me. I wanted that win so badly. It's good to then be reminded by other Christian brothers and sisters, your victory, your ability to be a spouse, to hold that high office, as it were, to do some mothering and some fathering, to make this certain amount of money or this job title, to get into that prestigious school program. Hey, your real victory, your ultimate identity, it was won secured on the cross. It's already done. Now you go out and do your best, and you take dominion, and you go after it. With all the talent and skill and ability God has given you, with all the ambition God has given you, go after it. Whatever goal you set. And if you come up short of the goal you set, you can certainly lean on the great peace that my actual victory, the one that actually matters the most, it's already been won. Oh, the peace with which we could go out into the world if we would learn from this brother in Christ who has his identity and priorities straight. That's a good opportunity, by the way, for good conversations out there and what he meant. So that's Scheffler. I can't remember. I already pressed X on that tab on my screen. But the winner of the Masters with a good line. Oh, yeah, I said that was substance, but then something for the broader movement, what it might mean. I think I said something like this recently, but just in case I didn't. Sports are the true meritocracy in the entertainment landscape. If people are primarily entertained by music, we'll call it movies, TV, it's really streaming, just content, and sports. So sports, music, and movies, TV. If those are the three primary methods of entertainment, the first two can be manipulated. The powerful folks in the music industry just tell you you're supposed to like Camila Cabello, and I don't get it, but I know I'm told I'm supposed to. I'm supposed to be a 38-year-old man who's going to look at a 21-year-old girl like Olivia Rodrigo and follow her around, and I'm not going to do that because that's gross. This is the thing I'm told I'm supposed to like, but I can just look back at it and say no, and it's not true meritocracy. There are incredible musicians, way better than the bubblegum pop garbage pressed forward, because they fit an agenda. They fit some kind of stereotype, or they click enough diversity boxes, and that's what gets pushed forward. What makes it out of all the Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Peacock studios is often to make a point, not to make good entertainment. So those aren't true meritocracies. They're sometimes infested with ideology. Sports, though. If you're good, you will rise to the top. Not necessarily sports media, because sports media will push people that just get attention. That could be Tim Tebow on one side, and it could be Michael Sam, the first openly gay player that tried to get into football. Both of them have about equal talent, by the way. Just kidding. Tim Tebow's a little bit better. But sports media might be corrupted, but not the sports themselves. And so here's what I'm starting to see, because this type of very public and theologically sound language is becoming more common among athletes. Not just the post-game, I think the big guy upstairs, but I'm talking some depth. C.J. Stroud showed this with the Houston Texans during the season. There's been some more that are just escaping me right now. I think what we're going to see is Christians who raise their kids well and not like the world. They raise their kids to encounter hard things and then to push through and do the hard thing anyway. For those kids that chose sports, they're going to end up being the best because their parents didn't let them flake out. Their parents didn't say, oh, well, that hurts your feelings. That doesn't make you feel good. Then you don't need to play. It's going to end up being, I think, we could see, give it 15, 20 more years, most of the dominant players in all the leagues are going to be maybe theologically sound Christian players because it's the one thing in our culture that's actually meritocratic. Well, hey, I'm not making a prophecy, so if I get it wrong, don't stone me. I'm making a prediction based on the data I'm seeing with me fully humbly saying, I could be wrong. I could see how I could get this wrong. But I'm encouraged by what's happening there in sports and the winner of the Masters. So that's what's going on there. All right, let's do this. The changing abortion politics of 2024. Young folks, gather around. When I was growing up, this was the paradigm on abortion in our country. There was a guy named Bill Clinton. You might not know about him. He was president from January of 1993 until January of 2001. He was a hillbilly, but a very smart hillbilly who was the governor of Arkansas, who was the proprietor of something called political triangulation, that he got elected as kind of a left moderate, but once he got his tail whipped in a midterm election in 1994, it was the largest swing in House seats in the history of the House of Representatives. I think it was 66 seats went from Democrat to Republican. He began to behave more moderately. He said things like, the era of big government is over, and he signed a criminal reform bill, a criminal justice reform bill that was very harsh on criminality. He signed a welfare reform bill that made people work or seek work in order to get benefits in many cases, not in all cases. So he triangulated, became more moderate, won kind of a landslide in 1996. That's Bill Clinton. Now, during that time period in history, he also popularized the phrase on abortion that he's pro-choice with because of these three things. Because we want abortion to be safe, legal, and rare. That was the stance on the left. The most leftward stance was abortion should remain legal. We like Roe versus Wade because abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. But we do want it rare. They were admitting begrudgingly, this isn't good. It's a thing that we need to have in our back pocket as an emergency, but it should be rare. The Republican, the rightist version of pro-lifeism, was basically Roe versus Wade is bad, and we should end abortion in every way that we possibly can. And as you know, we saw two summers ago, the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, allowing for the beginning of that process. So we once had an abortion landscape that I think could be faithfully depicted as pro-choice, I mean, that was the euphemism, but pro-choice versus pro-life. We don't have that anymore. Now the paradigm is no longer pro-choice versus pro-life. It's pro-abortion, straight up, abortion is good. It's a moral good that we have it, and we celebrate the women who are brave enough, this is their framing, not mine, brave enough to advocate for themselves and speak up for themselves and tell their stories. There's pro-abortion. And unfortunately, what it seems to be the case, is there isn't a pro-life party. There's now a pro-choice party. So we went from pro-choice versus pro-life to now pro-choice versus pro-abortion. And you might now say, Corey, prove that to me. What do you mean we don't have a pro-life party? I could just give you Carrie Lake's video. Carrie Lake is their presumed Republican nominee in Arizona to run for Senate, where she actually just straight up says in her video that we need abortions. We need them to be, she almost uses the language of safe, legal, and rare. That there's, she even uses the same old arguments that Clinton did. You know, you don't want to make a mistake with a guy and have to be tied to him forever. I mean, she uses the rape thing too, but she gets to the other stuff. Just people who are in poverty. You don't want someone in poverty to have a kid. These are the arguments she makes. That comes on the heels of the leader of the party on the right, the Republican Party, the former President Donald Trump, putting out a video saying that his abortion policy for this race is we're leaving it to the states. His policy is the federal government will not be touching this. The Supreme Court sent it to the states, and now each state is going to do what it is going to do what it will. And if in California that is abortion to the point of birth, then okay. And in South Carolina, if you ban it, all right, that's okay, but we're leaving it to the states. I don't know what else to call that but a pro-choice stance. Now, the state has the choice to make its own policy, and if there are pro-life states, then they will do pro-life things. It's getting to that point. We're on this topic, if it's important to you. There isn't really much of anyone on the federal level that even wants your vote. This is now an aside. I'm coming back to abortion. That's starting to be how it feels with the Republican candidate for president. Like, he doesn't even want conservative votes. Of course, he does. He wants all the votes he can get. But, I mean, he recently said here he has no interest in repealing Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, one of the worst laws in my lifetime to be passed. It is, I mean, this guy is, no question now, listen to me, he's to the left of every Republican nominee you've lived through. To the left of George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney. He's actually to the left of 2016 Trump. And now, is it good politics? I see what he's doing. He's got decent instincts. As horrific of a person as he is, he has decent instincts. He sees that his opponent is flanking as far to the left as he can, and he's trying to take up middle ground. So while it might be strategically wise, we need to have some clarity on the immorality of the position, that we are firmly pro-life. Now, that makes the abortion politics interesting, because let's say that Trump is able to take it off the table to some extent. You have a real problem on the left, because they sound insane. And if Trump is just saying, I'm not going to touch it, I don't even want to talk about it, we're done. We overturned Roe versus Wade. It's someone else now. Someone else has to deal with it, but I'm not touching it. He actually sounds like, not to me, but sounds like the more moderate voice on the topic, while the other side sounds insane. For example, as sounding insane, I want to play for you now a clip from Bill Maher. Bill Maher is one of the few people in the commentariat that I find honest. He's a classic liberal. He's a liberal from the 90s. He finds the leftism of today crazy and insane. And he's kind of fun to talk about those things sometimes. But he is an atheist and godless without any moral standards. And he recently had some folks on the show. They were talking abortion. He said this. It's about 45 seconds. I want to play the whole thing for you. While you're listening to this very horrific thing he's about to say, that I think is just honest. He's giving the honest position on abortion on the left. Now, the folks on the left might couch it, and they might disguise their position, but this very appalling thing you're about to hear from Bill Maher is ultimately the honest, the unveiled position on the American left. The thing I want you to listen out for is the crowd. This is a Bill Maher-loving Southern California crowd, and when they hear their own position recited back to them honestly without the euphemisms, they can't handle it. Here's Bill Maher.
Not if you believe it's murder. You know, that's why I don't understand the 15-week thing. Or the Trump's plan is, let's leave it to the states. You mean, so killing babies is okay in some states? Like, I can respect the absolutist position. I really can. I scold the left on when they say, oh, you know what? They just hate women, people who aren't pro-life, pro-choice. They don't hate women. They just made that up. They think it's murder. And it kind of is. I'm just okay with that. I am. I mean, there's 8 billion people in the world. I'm sorry, we won't miss you. That's my position on that. What?
That's quite harsh, Bill.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not
is
sure
that not your position if you're pro-
It cut off there, but his finish was, is that not your position if you're pro-choice? Well, yeah. That is the honest position, but no one says it that way. Could you hear how uncomfortable that crowd was? If you don't watch that show ever, I don't know, I probably watch a YouTube clip from it every week. Those pauses in there are usually filled in by some laughter or some cheers. There's probably even somebody that works from our show out in the crowd causing those reactions, like giving the crowd a cue, what they're supposed to do. But he just straight up says, they think it's murder, and it kind of is, and I'm just okay with that. And of course, his reasoning is appalling. He says there's 8 billion people on the earth. Like, we don't need you. We won't miss you. Goodness, Lord have mercy. And that guy's 70 years old, for real. Lord have mercy on his soul that he would hear the gospel and respond to it before it is eternally too late. I give you all of that just to come to this conclusion, and then we're doing something related to this after that. If you're a pro-life person like I am, you don't have a candidate. You have a candidate who is more pro-life than the other, because right, straight-up pro-abortion is different than leave it to the states. So I am wanting to say, don't let a political leadership deter your position, your good and right and righteous position, or dampen it. Just because a political leader that you feel like you have to have or is the weapon against your enemies is saying one thing, don't feel like you have to get in line. You don't. You can. This is where you speak truth to power and continue to say the right thing. Abortion is the worst thing America's done since our version of chattel slavery. It's a terrible thing we have done. It's a national sin, one we are probably, almost definitely, under judgment for right now, for which we are under judgment. And it needs to end. No matter what the leader of the rightist party says, it needs to end. Which then leads me here. J.D. Greer is a pastor of a fairly large church in Raleigh-Durham in Raleigh, North Carolina. He has been president of the Southern Baptist Convention in the past. I think he was president for 3 years. I like the guy. A lot of people of my theological bent, for whatever reason, are critical of him. I guess, for example, he's on the wrong side of this issue that we're going to vote on in June as a Southern Baptist Convention. The Southern Baptist Convention is going to meet in Indianapolis in June and try to affirm for a second time a constitutional amendment that clarifies, like we should, that the title of pastor is synonymous with elder and synonymous with overseer, and that those who hold that title, because of God's command and his order for the church, is reserved to men. And J.D. Greer is on the wrong side of that. Still an incredibly effective and a leader I could follow. I like J.D. Greer a lot. And so he goes out on Twitter after Trump puts out this video and critiques it. And straight says, no, we're still pro-life. We're still going after the ending of abortion in the country. And I noticed a lot of Trumpy evangelicals, those who have an ungodly affection for Donald Trump, starts just piling on J.D. Greer with, what have you said about Biden? What have you said about Biden's abortion thing? And I want to respond to that because I don't think it's a good critique. I don't think it's a fair critique for this reason. The people in Southern Baptist churches and most churches, especially in the South, they're not confused about the evil of abortion policy on the left. What I actually know about the people in those churches, especially, let's call it the 60 and up crowd, maybe the 50 and up crowd, they got more Tucker Carlson that week than they got any kind of Christian content. They got more Fox News that week than they got anything else. They know how evil the president is when it comes to abortion policy. It barely has to be discipled. It comes pre-installed. As people come to sit down in the seat every Sunday, pre-installed is an aversion to a lot of leftism, especially abortion. And so I don't like this philosophy that they seem to be taking from they being the critiquers of people like J.D. Greer on this. There's a acronym that I forgot from the communists. I'm talking about like the Chinese communists back in the day, the guy who wrote Rules for Radicals over here. I forgot his name as well. They would talk about having no enemies to the left. And it wasn't exactly that, but it was an acronym for saying, we will criticize no one to our left. So even if there's someone left of me, I know they're good-hearted. They are going after the same thing. Even if I think their tactics are bad, I will never criticize anyone to my left. No enemies to the left. And there seems to be an equal and opposite bad reaction. I would say a bad reaction on the right that says no enemies to the right. If they are generally on our side, they will have no criticism. And so if you are criticizing Trump at all, they come after you because there should be no enemies to your right. And all of your enemies should just be on the left. And all of your critique and all of your fire should be that direction. And I just, for those two reasons, reason one, it comes pre-discipled by a lot of the media our people consume. And second, when it comes to the time I'm going to spend either using my social media or guys like him using their social media, use your time to clarify hard things. Use your time to disciple the things that are less likely to be said or that someone might have the, I guess, fear to say because, wait, let me say it this way. That's it. I found the way to say it. Criticizing a left-wing president when you are a Southern Baptist pastor, I mean this, it takes zero courage. That's just a party. Everybody piles on because we all know it came pre-installed. To criticize a figure on the right, especially this particular figure on the right, who some people are super emotionally attached to, that's the thing that actually takes some courage. That's the actual hard thing to say. And so, listen, I'm not trying to sway you one way or the other on what you do in November. I have no interest, really, in swaying you one way or the other. I have dear friends who have explained to me their upcoming Trump vote, and I get it. I understand. But I'm just trying to make clear where he stands and then where we should stand in opposition over the long haul to trying to get the worst sin in our nation right now to stop. I have one other topic around the political sphere I want to get to. It's a very interesting question that someone posed on Twitter, and we'll get back to that here in just a second. It has been a theme on the show for a couple years now that what we're trying to do, the best I can is know the scriptures, especially the wisdom of the Old Testament laws, and bring that into the modern day and what that might look like. That's hard because sometimes we read a law about someone falling off someone's roof because that person didn't put a railing around their roof, and you start to wonder, all right, this law in Exodus, how's that apply to my life? That's a fair question to ask. And, well, I suspect you've not fallen off anyone's roof because they were negligent and did not put a railing around it. But the modern-day equivalent might have happened to you, and I think that modern-day equivalent would be getting hurt at work or getting hurt in a car accident. I know those things can have some serious consequences. The medical bills pile up while you're losing wages. And that's also why you're just trying to recover physically from whatever damage was done. All the while, there's actually a process you need to try to navigate to get justice. I don't want you to be intimidated by it. Don't be scared of it. There are people out there that can help you. The one I want to point you to is a personal friend of mine. His name is Samuel Harms, as in stay out of harm's way. That's Samuel Harms, H-A-R-M-S. You can Google him, or you can reach him at 864-666-6666. That's Samuel Harms, attorney at law. For real, don't try to do it alone. Reach out to somebody who can help. And that someone I want to point you towards is Samuel Harms here in Greenville at 33 Market Point Drive, Greenville, South Carolina, 29607. The number is 666-6666. So if you have been hurt by someone's negligence, maybe not falling off the roof for lack of a parapet, but because of some other issue in a car accident or being hurt at work, give Samuel Harms a call today. That's 864-666-6666. Here was the interesting question that got posed on Twitter that is worth exploring. Where'd I put it? There it is. Okay. This is from a Twitter account that I can't endorse or tell you not to follow because I don't know anything else except for this one question. His question is this. Which of these scenarios is better for America long term? Now, before I give you the scenarios, I like questions like this because you live in an age that says, right now, we got to get it fixed right now. We have 4 years. We have 2 years. For example, you're in that era right now where people are telling you this is the most important election of your lifetime. I can't stand those people. Don't listen to those people. They don't know what they're talking about. This isn't the last election. That happens on the left, too. They act like if Trump wins, it's our last election. And we're not going to have any more after that. And that's crazy and absurd and kooky, and don't listen to those people either. Now, so that allows us to think long term. As I sit here at 38, I assume 50 more years. What might the long-term plan be? Because consider this. There are times in warfare that surrendering on one part of the map is is ultimately good for the war. It's not good for that battle. It doesn't look good in the moment. It might hurt morale, something like that. But it was the right move in the long run. So I don't see either of these presidential candidates to be wins. These types of elections are judgments. They're judgments on a country where your federal government leaders are just wicked men. But that's why this question is interesting. So here's the question. Which of these scenarios is better for America long term? A, Trump for 4 years, followed by 8 years of California Governor Gavin Newsom, or Biden for 4 more years, followed by 8 years of Ron DeSantis? That is intriguing. Because we are a pendulum country. We swing wildly left to right, Democrat to Republican. You've lived through that if you've been paying attention these last 30, 40 years. That's where we are. That's actually what's happening right now in the polling. It's just people aren't swinging for Trump. They're swinging against Biden. We're just a pendulum country. We swing wildly back and forth. And so that question here being, make the assumption whoever wins in 2024, the opposing party will win 2 terms starting in 2028. What would be, I only say this for this reason. As a non-Trump voter who has respect for Trump voters, I would ask that you have that similar respect, especially for those that think strategically like that. The idea here that if Trump is vanquished and leftism accelerates itself and becomes all the less attractive, which just introduces a figure into the system that is quite disruptive, like a DeSantis, disruptive in a good way, is that worth it? And equally, someone who would, an ideology, like Gavin Newsom is the guy just feels satanic. He's a rabid secularist. Is getting what you want right now with Trumpism, would it be worth it if it did end in an administration for Newsom? Ultimately, for us, the Christian, we can know we can just be faithful with where we are right now. We can think strategically towards the future, but knowing that the Lord lifts up kings and presidents and prime ministers, and he puts them down, and the Lord is in control of these things. So I'm not going to worry about it. I am thinking it's worth considering that question just as a matter of recognizing someone might not think like you and have a different calculation on what they're looking for, and there should be some mutual respect around that. I'll make this the last one, and maybe this episode won't be nearly as long as I thought it was going to be. I ran across another tweet from someone else in the Southern Baptist Convention, someone who is going to the convention in Indianapolis and is on the opposite side of that issue I just told you about. When we get together in Indianapolis, we are going to try to do again what we did in New Orleans. In New Orleans last year, we affirmed a constitutional amendment one time. To make it official, you have to do it again the second time. To clarify, the office of pastor, overseer, elder, all synonymous, and therefore the titles need to match. The issue we're largely having is ambiguity, where just traditionally someone has a music pastor. Traditionally, they call it a children's pastor. They don't mean that. They don't mean elder in the church. They don't mean holding the office. And we just think it's important. I know I think it's important to get these things clarified. Now, this tweet I thought was worth considering. I think he's got a point, ultimately wrong, but I think he's got a good point. The tweet was something like, denominations are confessional. They agree on a long list of things that we believe. Conventions, what Southern Baptists are missional. They agree on the mission, agreeing to disagree about many things that are confessional so that we can just stay on the mission. So his argument would be, the overall mission is to plant churches, make converts overseas, grow churches with genuine believers. That's the goal. The goal is the Great Commission, or at least the part of the Great Commission that is make disciples, and I think they would say make converts and build churches. I can largely get behind that notion, sentiment. The word I was looking for was sentiment. I can be in some real disagreement on dispensationalism inside the Southern Baptist Convention. I could be in real disagreement with people on the attractional model of church versus that we meet together for the purpose of glorifying a God and the upbuilding of the believer, and still partner together for mission. We can be missionally aligned while having some philosophical things that are separate, and I feel very good about that, to be in the convention. What I would say back to these brothers, because I know some, I have some pastors who listen, this particular issue is important enough that it needs to be closed, that it is confessional. So much so that I am saying that if there is a Southern Baptist church that has women on staff that they are calling pastors, it is worth removing them. It's that big of an issue. The missional, the attractional model of church, you're holding to some kind of dispensationalism. I think we're good. We can be partnered. But this part of the confession is so important, so fundamental to God's design for men and women, that yes, it actually is worth separating from one another and not partnering on the mission because we don't match on this confession. And I feel like I have some credibility on this because it is my nature to draw broader boundaries, to say in a given ministry setting, we disagree on some things and we can still partner. I have probably more space to include other opinions than a lot of others do. And so I'm predisposed to inclusion. That's my personal, sometimes even fleshly predilection, is to inclusion. I'm saying, with my predisposition, we got to close this one off. This is so big to the design of men and women, their purposes, and for the design of leadership in the church. I'm drawing a hard line. And if I'm drawing a hard line, if I am with the people drawing a hard line, I'm trying to appeal to others who would say, hey, well, let's just partner because we have the same mission. I just come down here. Guys, if the mission is to make converts and then plant churches and make churches overseas, if those churches aren't led by or planted by people settled on this issue, I don't want that church planted. That church could be dangerous in that new country that's just learning Christianity. I don't want to do what the charismatics have largely done in Africa and in parts of Southeast Asia and make some converts, and then it's a bunch of new apostolic reformation charismatic craziness. I know this sounds harsh. A church that doesn't have this settled, I don't really have a lot of interest in helping that church get planted. I don't have a lot of interest in having those converts come together around a church and embodiment that does not have this issue of male headship, both in the family and in the church structure, because God designed it that way for no other reason. God just designed it that way. Go grab 1 Timothy 2 or 3. Just give it a read. Go to Genesis 1, 2, 3 and just see it. See the beauty of the design. And so in this case, I'm just saying, while it's a good point, hey, we can be missional and not be totally confessional. Got it. But this should be part of the confession. And it's worth separating from each other over the mission to get this confession unified. If you have comments or responses, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or Threads. Look for me, Corey Truax. It's easy to find me there. You can also respond on CoreyTruaxShow@gmail.com. CoreyTruaxShow@gmail.com if you want to tell me how wrong I am about any given thing, or you have stories that you think should be covered. Again, I'm grateful that you listen. Thank you for giving me time every week. If the Lord allows it, I'll be back with another new edition of the Corey Truax Show next week. Until then, everybody, peace and love.